This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Schools are supposed to be a place for learning, growth, and for building a better future and society. But in some schools, students are confronted with a cycle of violence. First, there's interpersonal violence from and among their peers. And then, as my next guest formulates it, there's structural violence from school administrators in the form of punishment and school suspension. There are also racial disparities, as K-12 students who are black are suspended at a disproportionate rate, 15% of the school-age population receiving 39% of suspensions. Our guest, Charles Bell, says school punishment and suspensions do not work. Studies show that students who have been suspended are more likely to drop out, be arrested, and be incarcerated later in life. And he says this cycle of violence has ripple effects for parents, educators, and communities. Dr. Bell is an assistant professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University and the author of the recently released book, Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. Charles Bell, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here today.
And listeners, our lines are open for this conversation. 800-222-9455 is the number. What do you think about school punishment and suspension? Were you or a child in your life ever suspended? How did it affect them? And do you think school punishment should change? If you have a question for our guest, we can take your call. We want to hear from you. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. So, Professor Charles Bell, the first line in the introduction of your book is, schools are battlegrounds, sites of structural and interpersonal violence. I think that might strike some listeners as a harsh statement. So can you talk about why you say that?
Yes. So when I interviewed 110 Black students and parents, one of the overarching sort of comments that they stated is that for some students, school can be a very friendly place. It's a place where children are running around, they're having fun, and there's letters and numbers on the wall. But the parents and students that I interviewed, Black students and parents in the Southeast Michigan area, are saying, not for me. This is not my experience, because the moment that I enter school, I'm being criminalized. I'm being forced to walk through metal detectors, guards, and law enforcement officers. I'm in an environment where there's no books, there's no resources. I'm walking into a chemistry lab and there's no running water. There's no chemistry equipment, there's no books. And so I'm meeting sort of structural violence where this environment is criminalizing my behavior. They're removing resources and I don't know why. That's what children are saying to me.
In the second chapter, you write about what you call the code of violence. And I was struck by the part about your own personal experiences about fighting in school. You write that in the 1990s, you recall receiving 8 out-of-school suspensions between 3rd and 7th grade. Can you talk about your own experiences growing up and how you got caught in this code of violence and the cycle of school suspensions?
Sure. So I grew up in a really tough neighborhood in Detroit, a really politically neglected area in Michigan. And when I went to school, and most just like most other students, once you're challenged to a fight or somebody threatens you, you have to address those attacks. You have to address those threats or you will be victimized. And I found myself in a very similar situation. So I was challenged to a fight in 3rd grade. And I knew that I could not back down, because if I backed down, I'd be attacked on the way home. I'd be attacked in schools. And I'm giving the perception that I'm weak. So I had to fight back and I had to defend myself or be attacked. And what I found is that, and I look back on my behavior and my the influences for my behavior, and what I found is that just living in an environment where there's shootings and there's violence all day and there's no legitimate economic opportunities, it just creates a very hostile environment that is traumatizing for children. There's all kinds of things that are going on in my community, and I didn't know how to make sense of it as a child. And I think many children struggle with this. They're in an environment that they don't understand. They don't know why the police respond to certain instances or don't respond to certain crimes, and they don't know why that I'm walking into this environment and there's metal detectors, there's guards, and there's law enforcement officers. But when I need them to protect me, no one's there. And that was exactly my experience. When I'm being attacked, no one is there to help me. So I'm forced to protect myself or suffer victimization.
You use the Detroit school system in the book as your main example, but is it a microcosm for a larger problem in other places? I mean, Rockford, Peoria, Springfield, Bloomington, Normal, Champaign, Urbana, Chicago, elsewhere in the Midwest?
Yes, that's a great question. And I use the Detroit and I use the inner city and suburban school districts in Michigan, pretty much throughout Michigan as an example. But I've also interviewed students here in Illinois that I did not include in the book intentionally because I felt even though their experiences were significantly similar to students in the Detroit area, I felt that their sort of narrative was slightly different because they were fleeing from Chicago, they're fleeing from Rockford, and they're fleeing a sort of similar structural violence and political violence, but the context was very different for them. So I think that a second book and a separate project is appropriate there. But their experiences were very similar. Even in Illinois, I found that many of these students are trapped in this system of violence, trauma that is unaddressed. And many of these children are saying that there's no place in my community or in my school that I can talk about trauma, that I can talk about where I grew up and how that affects me, or I can talk about the challenges that I'm facing on the way to school, on the way home from school, and how just thinking about not being able to picture myself being alive at 18, the difficulty of navigating life outside of school makes it really difficult for me to believe that I can be successful in school. I think that is a really important dynamic that we need to really address in our society. These children need a space where they can talk.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Charles Bell, who's an assistant professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University. His new book is called Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. We're going to continue talking about it when we come back from a short break. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. More conversation with Professor Charles Bell after the break. This is The 21st. Stay with us.
Support for The 21st comes from Christie Clinic. Christie Clinic, providing health care to the community for more than 90 years. Local procedures, providers, specialties, and choice. Christie Clinic is focused on caring for the community. Support comes from the Champaign Park District, presenting Renee Elise Goldsberry, original Broadway cast member from Hamilton, live in concert at the Virginia Theater on Saturday, November 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information are available online at thevirginia.org.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Professor Charles Bell from Illinois State University. He's in criminal justice sciences there. And more to the point for our conversation today, he's the author of Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 800-222-9455, especially if you have an experience with school discipline. Maybe you were suspended, or maybe a child in your life was suspended. We want to know how that affected you, how that affected your education and home life. 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. So you write in the book that... As I mentioned this earlier, there's that statistic that K-12 school administrators suspend youth who are Black at disproportionate rates, and you write that schools are anti-Black institutions. How so?
That's a great question. So when I interviewed the students, I was really listening to the totality of what they were telling me. I'm walking into a school and my hair is being criminalized. I'm being suspended because of my hairstyle. I'm being suspended because of my music preference in school. I'm being suspended even when I didn't do anything wrong, my behavior is being criminalized, and teachers are viewing me as a criminal before I even do anything wrong. And I think that connecting their statements to the history of schools in America was really important to help me reach this conclusion that schools are anti-Black institutions. So we have to be mindful of the fact that before 1954, Black students could not walk into a school with white students. It was illegal. And this is sort of a state-sanctioned, approved segregation. And even after 1954, with the Brown v. Board of Court decision, which desegregated public schools, many communities resisted this court order well into the 1970s. And then right after the 1970s, specifically in Michigan, 1970, Judge Damon Keith issues a court order and forces Pontiac Public Schools to racially integrate. And then nationally, we have the school to prison pipeline emerges in the 1974 publication by the Children's Defense Fund. So we have a history here of Black students being removed from school or even being sort of banned from public schools, and this the government sort of sanctioning this process.
I wonder what you say. I mean, I personally went to a school. I knew kids who were suspended. We had a vice principal who was in charge of discipline. He was African-American. And I'm sure a lot of the school administrators that, you know, of the schools you were writing about were themselves Black. But I think obviously you're trying to identify something systemic. Can you talk about the interplay between those maybe individual actors who are carrying out these decisions to suspend or whatever punishment they mete out and, you know, the fact that many of them are themselves Black?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic. But we cannot forget that many of these zero tolerance policies have removed the discretion from the local stakeholders. So zero tolerance. If you're in a fight, and it doesn't matter if you're the victim, you're getting beat up, you are suspended. And that's part of the zero tolerance policy culture that manifested in public schools throughout the 90s. And we've tried to get rid of, and with school discipline reforms nationally, but we've been relatively unsuccessful in most cases because we've underestimated the culture of punishment that has set into a lot of these schools. It's this sort of deeply rooted system of punishment. So the policies, even though the school administrators may be Black in some cases, relatively few cases, because we have to remind ourselves that most education stakeholders are white. And so even when you have a Black administrator, a lot of times their hands are tied, or a lot of times they're in a school where the culture of punishment is so deeply rooted that to go against that is to be an outcast in some cases.
How does school suspension and discipline affect student achievement?
Yes, so there's numerous studies that show us that school suspensions harm students' grades. However, we have very little research that shows how that happens. And what I found is three pathways in which school suspensions harm students' grades. The first one is just missing high point value assignments. A lot of these students miss one day of school, one day. And it just happened to be a day where they missed a quiz or an exam. So there's a 100-point test. They missed it. They got a zero, and their grades declined sharply because of that. The second pathway is where students miss class. They had a 5-day suspension or 10-day suspension. I even had some students receive illegal suspensions for as long as 30 or 40 days. And their parents just said, I can't compensate for the missed instruction. You're out of school. I don't know what your lesson plan is. I don't have a textbook. And I can't help you in most cases. I'm doing the best that I can. I'm working full time and I'm coming home and I'm helping you, but I don't know your curriculum. And that's what most parents are telling me. The third sort of pathway, which was overwhelmingly for students who had low socioeconomic status, students who were largely coming from working class and poor families, they found that educators would not give them their makeup work. The educators used their discretion to form negative opinions of students who receive suspensions, and then they denied students access to their makeup work.
So I want to provide a sort of ask about a hypothetical right here. Like, well, let's say you have a student who is fighting and disruptive in class. Instead of suspending him, the school keeps him in class. And now, you know, instead of that one student not learning, the entire class of 30 people is, you know, has this disruptive presence. What would be a reasonable and constructive consequence to, you know, a student who breaks school rules? And again, and maybe we'll set aside the sort of the rules, like you mentioned hair is one, and there's actually a, I'm sure you're aware, a law that's been passed in Illinois. It goes into effect next year, sort of preventing discrimination based on hairstyles. But, you know, if somebody is really disruptive, what is a constructive way for a school to deal with that in your view?
This is a great question as well. And this is where the sort of political violence comes into play. So the constructive thing to do is to pull that student out of class, refer them to a counselor or psychologist, someone that they can talk to find out exactly why they are behaving in this way. There needs to be a collaborative approach. And a lot of times when students are behaving problematically or engaging in violence, it's because something's going on in the community or at home. A lot of these children that are behaving in this way come from traumatized environments. So they're acting out their trauma, which is very similar to what I did at home. I was living in a very traumatized environment. There was lots of trauma in my household. So I acted out at school. And someone needs to recognize that this is not a bad child. This is a traumatized child. This is a child that needs an opportunity to talk, an intervention, some help, not to be criminalized. And I think that when we talk to educators and we tell them that this is what they need to do, the educator's response is that, well, I have 40 students in my class. I have 30 students in my class, and I can't do that. And that's where the political violence comes into play, because we know that research tells us that there shouldn't be more than 20 students in a class to have sort of adequate learning. We know that teachers can't educate 40 students in a classroom and take care of these minor infractions that occur. Therefore, policymakers have handicapped teachers when they intentionally under-resource schools and take resources away. And then we have schools that are overcrowded, and they know this. And I think this is sort of intentional, and because we don't see this in suburban areas. You don't go into a suburban school district and see 40 students in a class. This is exclusively in urban areas, and we have to question why.
Let me just take a moment to reintroduce my guest. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Charles Bell, who is from Illinois State University, and he's the author of the recently released book, Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us in the last few minutes we have in our conversation today. We did hear from a caller who did not stay on the line, but Wynn from Champaign called in to say that at least a few years ago, schools in that area implemented a system where students who were suspended were not sent home, but instead were sent to a program called Actions. And apparently they worked on academics and social emotional work during the day. Is this something you encountered in your research? Do you view this as one of the constructive alternatives to suspension?
So the students that I talked to in my research, they never had any other alternatives. Out of school suspension was the only alternative for them. There was never a detention option or an in-school suspension option. They were immediately suspended, sometimes for 5 days, 10 days, but quite often illegally, and just pretty much told not to return. And I think that an intervention of this nature would be helpful in most cases. And I would have to do a little bit more research just to see exactly what they're doing and how they're carrying it out. But I think that we need to think critically about what we're doing to children when we suspend them, because we're removing them from school, a place that we know they need to be. And they know they need a high school diploma and increasingly a college education. And we're removing them from the environment for, in many cases, very minor infractions, or we're completely misinterpreting their behavior.
You have a chapter in your book about educators and how you would not recommend being a teacher and how educators don't feel safe. What's happening? What needs to change there?
Yes. So many of the educators that I interviewed, and this is not me saying this, this is the educator saying this. The educator stated that it's a really difficult career. They feel they're underpaid, they're underappreciated in most cases because they're trapped in this system between the student's trauma and how to handle that and how to teach the lesson in class. And then they're stuck between the politicians who remove resources from schools and compel teachers to spend their resources to buy books and resources and pens and paper, things that they should never have to pay for. So many of the teachers are frustrated by this. they don't feel safe because a lot of times students have lashed out at teachers, and we've seen several high profile incidents of this. And I think that many teachers are questioning their commitment to the profession at this point. And we've seen teacher shortages play out nationally. And if we're not going to protect teachers, if we're not going to keep them safe, and if we're not going to invest the resources that teachers need to properly educate our children, then who can blame them if they remove themselves from this career and discourage other individuals from pursuing it? This is a national social problem that really needs a conversation from the highest levels of government.
You end your book with the idea of rethinking school punishment and safety. And we only have a couple of minutes left in our conversation. So what are some of the reforms that you advocate for when it comes to school punishment or discipline or wherever you think this should go?
Yeah, so school punishment, there are several reform ideas that I have. But the first is that we need a national sort of conversation on school discipline reform. This isn't something that we can solve in a day. We didn't create this problem in a day. We need a national sort of call for action, and playing out at the local level, at schools, we need students, parents, school officials, researchers, policymakers in a room talking about school discipline policy. And all the stakeholders in the room have equal voice. To date, we've created school punishment policy. We've excluded parents and teachers. We've excluded parents and students. And we've just sort of imposed a top-down model. This is what you're going to do. This is how you're going to discipline. And there's never any input. So that's the first thing that needs to happen, a national conversation. I think the second thing that needs to happen is we've passed school discipline reform laws throughout the country. Illinois has passed one. Michigan has passed another bill. In Illinois, it's Senate Bill 100. Michigan, it's House Bills 5618 through 5621. And what politicians did is they passed these bills and they never checked to see if the bills were actually effective. And what I found time and time again is that school suspensions have actually increased in response to these bills. And I've had administrators tell me to my face that until the legislature produces a bill that punishes me for issuing suspensions, I'm going to continue to do so because we've been doing this for 30 years. It's worked great for us, and there's no problem. When we have 40 students in a class, this is the only alternative. And finally, we need a sort of bill that calls for if a student is suspended, they get their makeup work. No educator should be allowed to deny a student access to their makeup work simply because they are suspended.
Dr. Charles Bell is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice Sciences at Illinois State University and author of Suspended: Punishment, Violence, and the Failure of School Safety. Charles Bell, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your work on the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to visit our website. You can revisit some of our past conversations there. You can also subscribe to our podcast. You'll have links there. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. That's The 21st. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.